From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, Wisconsin has more than 3,000 local governments. We look at the history of these governments and how consolidation could impact local communities. Then a futurist sums up how we should prepare for, well, the future.
Give up on answers. Stick with questions. In a world that's accelerating as fast as ours, nobody has the answer. And so that then means we have to ask better questions about the future.
And Wisconsin's oldest legislator, 92-year-old Senator Fred Risser, praises Wisconsin's youngest, 20-year-old Representative Kalen Haywood.
I think it's wonderful that we have people like Kalen representing areas in this state. The state needs diverse representation. They need young people. They need older people. They need males, they need females, they need whites, they need blacks, they need all.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Local governments are incredibly important to our communities. They are largely responsible for our schools, our roads, and the many services we depend on, like police and firefighters. But too many local governments can be problematic. It can mean overlapping responsibilities and potentially a waste of taxpayer dollars. According to a new report by the Wisconsin Policy Forum, the state has more than 3,000 local governments, the 11th most in the country. Jason Stein is the research director for the forum, and Ari Brown is a data and research analyst. They join Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the state of Wisconsin's governments, and Brown starts by explaining how we got here.
Wisconsin is not unlike most of the other states in the upper Midwest, and also not unlike a lot of states in the upper Northeast part of the country in New England. So when Wisconsin was kind of being settled, there were things like the Northwest Ordinance, these things that set up a system where the land was kind of surveyed out by these kind of 6 mile by 6 mile township types of government. So that not only established the towns and cities and villages that we have today, but also a lot of the things like the school districts. So throughout time, we've kind of always had the system where every inch of the state was kind of dictated as this is what it's going to be, this is how it's going to look. And since the time, since, you know, the late 1700s, early 1800s, and then into the establishment of the state, this is kind of the system that has spelled out how things look today. It was obviously much easier then to establish these governments than it has been since then to take them away. So a lot of the system that we have right now was kind of dictated, you know, hundreds of years ago. One of the big reductions that we've seen from that system that dictated every inch of the state was a massive reduction in the number of school districts from basically the end of World War II until about the early 70s. And that happened because there was a big structural change in the state where you had, a lot of these school districts that existed where there wasn't as much of a population. You used to kind of need a school district pretty much everywhere because, you know, cars weren't really a thing yet. Children were walking to school. But over time, people got cars, you know, people kind of moved to urban centers, and not every school district was fully functional. There were school districts that had 10 students or less. There were a lot of school districts that had one classroom, one teacher, and then school districts that just were fully not operational anymore. So there was kind of legislation passed in the 40s and 50s that got rid of a bunch of those school districts. So that's been one major change. The other major change has been an increase in what we call special district governments, what the Census Bureau refers to as special district governments. These are governments that are created kind of with the purpose of addressing a specific issue. So in Wisconsin, we have a lot of lake districts, a lot of sewerage districts, sanitary districts, things that basically manage Wisconsin's water. We are a state that has a lot of lakes, so this is the kind of thing that's important. And these kind of have evolved throughout. They kind of started to rise in the 70s and 80s, and then a big uptick in the 90s. These were initially created lake districts, for example. There's a study by the state that basically found that that local governments were having a difficult time fully managing what was going on with their lakes. We just happen to have a lot. So one of the solutions that was kind of pitched was the establishment of these separate governments whose sole focus would be managing Wisconsin's water. And that has been kind of the thing that we've seen rising since the early and mid-1970s.
Well, and I'd like to take a step back and really define what we mean when we say governments, because I hear that word and I instinctively think, okay, so a city, a village, something of that kind, but governments actually has a much broader meaning in this case.
Sure. So, you know, we're looking at local governments here. So there's a lot of things that you can be talking about. You can be talking about counties, cities, villages, towns, sort of, you know, governments that take on, you know, general functions. And then you have governments that are sort of aimed at a specific thing. So you have school districts, you have technical college districts, and you have the special districts that Ari was just talking about. And again, you know, some of this is just how you define it, and you could define it in different ways, but you're looking at some entity that has, you know, an organization, it has some sort of a corporate structure and powers, it's providing some sort of public services, and it has some kind of fiscal and administrative independence. So, you know, again, I mean, these would be the sorts of governments that have, you know, the ability to tax you, for instance, you know, as, you know, a city does, a technical college district does, a school district does. You know, these are some of the things that you see. And again, here we're using Census Bureau data and that definition that's built into that data.
Well, and you talked about this a little before, about how Wisconsin compares to other states, particularly in the upper Midwest and the Northeast. But, you know, just among the United States in general, how does Wisconsin stack up?
Sure. So we found that in the 2017 Census of Governments, Wisconsin had the 11th most governments of any state. And then when you kind of parse that out to compare to population, Wisconsin had the 15th most governments per capita. Which, you know, was again, pretty much in line with the rest of the upper Midwest. Not really shocking in terms of past years. You know, we had states like Illinois had the most, Pennsylvania was third, Ohio fifth, Minnesota eighth. So Wisconsin is very much in line with its neighbors, but those neighbors and Wisconsin compared to the rest of the country, relatively high.
And I guess, you know, what's the upshot here? What are the issues with having so many governments? Is there a problem with that?
Well, so I think anytime you're somewhat different than the rest of the country, it's always worth taking a look at that and really asking, you know, are we doing things in the highest and best way? And I think what you don't want a knee-jerk reaction one way or the other. It's certainly saying that you have a lot of governments isn't exactly the same as saying your governments are inefficient. You know, at the same time, it is worth looking at, are there parts of government that are duplicating services, you know, that might be able to collaborate and work together to deliver services? Again, if you look at, say, the number of municipalities in Wisconsin, you know, cities, villages, and towns, we have more than 1,800. Obviously, you know, there are not every state has the sort of town form of government that we have. And certainly, you know, we have a very large number. And so one of the other things that our organization does is looks at service sharing opportunities, you know, that local governments have to, you know, look at things like fire and emergency medical services, public health, things like that, to see, are there areas where local governments could either deliver services that are better, cheaper than they could if they didn't work with one another.
Well, and something that your report gets into is, you know, overlapping responsibilities. Are we seeing a lot of districts where there is that kind of push and pull for who's actually responsible for what?
Well, sure. I mean, there's obviously, you know, a number of those potential areas. For instance, there can be dispatch services for police and fire, you know, first responders. There can be public health. You know, there's all the sorts of back office functions that government does. So, I mean, you know, there's street and road maintenance. There's all kinds of areas where, you know, various governments in a certain area may be doing the same service or might be able to collaborate with one another on doing those services. The other thing that may be worth adding too is that, you know, one thing is the number of governments you have, but, you know, even within a single government like the state, you can have programs like programs around worker training that many different agencies may be working in and that may be somewhat duplicative. So, you know, when you're talking about government duplicating services, you know, it's not a simple question of, you know, are there too many government units? Are there too few? You know, this sort of duplication and potential inefficiency can arise in lots of different ways.
So, you know, you talked about consolidation, consolidating services in some cases. What does consolidation look like in cases, I guess, like this?
Well, it really varies. You know, you just take a function like dispatch for emergency services. You know, in some places that's handled at a municipal level. I mean, that can be handled at a county level. You can have, again, certain services like fire and rescue can be very capital intensive, right? So, you know, it can be very expensive to have fire trucks, to have fire stations. You know, you may have in areas where you have a lot of municipalities, if each municipality is, you know, providing that sort of equipment to serve a fairly limited geographic area, you know, you may have opportunities for sharing equipment or trained staff that might be more efficient. But, you know, and again, a lot of these are decisions that are not just policy or public safety decisions, but they're also political decisions about what do the voters and the taxpayers in those areas, what do they value? What is important to them? You know, there may be for a school district, the local identity that a school district brings may be very valuable to the people of that community. It may be so valuable that they're willing to pay more than they would otherwise have to pay to retain it. So, you know, again, this isn't a situation where there are easy answers, but in putting this basic data out there about what Wisconsin governments look like, we hope that provokes a little more informed discussion about how we're doing things and how we want to do them moving forward.
Well, and I guess that was my last question, really. What do you hope local governments in particular, but people who see this report, what do you hope they take away?
Yeah, so one of the reasons that we kind of did this report was we got this new data. The Census of Governments data comes out every 5 years. And it's really, I think, just kind of a time to take a step back and really bird's eye view, see what's going on with this state. One of the things, you know, obviously that I hope comes out of this is just a kind of constant consideration of how can we best serve our constituents, regardless of what type of government. You know, is a school district providing education to its students in the most efficient way? Are, as Jason mentioned, are the you know, fire and EMS services of all of these bordering municipalities delivering their dispatch services to their constituents in a way that is most effective? So that's really one thing that we wanted to look at. One of the things that we kind of note in here was that there was this big kind of commission done in the early 2000s called the Cattle Commission that looked at this exact same question. And one of the things that they kind of arrived at was basically, you know, elimination is not really an option most of the time. So they wanted to look at, you know, what are the best ways that governments can talk to each other and best deliver for their constituents. And I think that's one thing that we wanted to get at too, is just that, you know, these are really important services that are delivered to the people of Wisconsin. There are a ton of governments in this state, and it's going to be really important that, you know, as we kind of move forward with all of these governments, that we're constantly looking at, you know, what are the ways that governments can talk to each other and deliver.
And one other just last point is, you might say, well, efficiency, what would that look like? Maybe to some people that would look like eliminating a number of governments. You know, at the same time, we see in recent years there was a creation of something called long-term care districts that provide care in the community to the elderly and disabled. So in other words, you know, in some cases, helping elderly residents stay in their homes longer rather than going into more expensive nursing home care. So, you know, there you're creating more governments, but they're also working at a regional level to deliver services rather than at the level of individual counties, as was often the case in the past. So there, you know, arguably you have a more efficient service being delivered. You have more governments in terms of the raw numbers, but you also have them working more at a regional level and less at a more localized level. So, you know, again, you don't want to think about purely in knee-jerk terms or purely in overly simplistic approaches, that there's lots of ways where you may be able to arrive at better services for the vulnerable people of the state as well as for its taxpayers.
Yeah. Well, Jason, Ari, thank you so much for speaking with me today and sharing your work.
It's our great pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Jason Stein is the research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and Ari Brown is a data and research analyst for the forum. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can find more of our conversations with the Wisconsin Policy Forum folks at WUWM.com. Coming up after a break, what the future looks like. Think change, change, and more change. We'll talk with futurist Jack Uldrich when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. In this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes. Well, were Benjamin Franklin alive today, he might have amended his famous line to include one other certainty: change. A futurist who spoke in Milwaukee this week says virtually everything we think we understand, from education to the business world to healthcare, is changing so rapidly we can't even imagine many of the jobs today's first graders will hold after they graduate from high school. And the rate of change is not going to slow down. Minnesota-based writer, lecturer, and consultant Jack Uldrich took part in a networking event at Marquette University about workforce and innovation. While at Marquette, he spoke with WUWM's innovation reporter Chuck Kornbach about what is transforming tomorrow.
The first trend is just the rate of change itself. It's accelerating. I think the easiest way to think about this is today is the slowest rate of change any of us are ever going to see again. And the students and the faculty here at Marquette and every other academic institution around the world needs to appreciate that as well. We need to change education, and workforce is going to demand it.
And is it computers that are changing things?
It's not just computers. It's a wide variety of technologies. It's advances in artificial intelligence, something known as the Internet of Things, which is a world of sensor technology. It's 3D printing, it's robotics, it's autonomous vehicles, it's virtual reality, augmented reality, continued medical advances in biotechnology, nanotechnology, stem cell research. All of these are moving at a really fast pace. And from my perspective as a futurist, no industry is going to look as it looks today in 10 years' time. And both industry needs to understand that, and our teachers and our professors need to begin preparing our students for a potentially radically different future.
Is it competition? Everybody wants to be the first with something? What's going on?
First, it is. Our tools themselves are getting exponentially more powerful. Now we have advances in quantum computing, which is speeding up advances in material science and drug discovery. But the other accelerants are money. Capital is fueling a lot of these advances. And then just the sheer fact that half the globe now has access to a computer in their hand. And so we have 4 million individuals who are educating themselves on the internet, who are entrepreneurial in spirit, and are bringing different perspectives to a lot of long-standing and once traditional businesses.
And you're saying institutions are going to have to adjust. How does education need to adjust, for example?
Education needs to adjust by understanding. I'm going to sum it up for you in 7 words. I say to education institutions, give up on answers, stick with questions. In a world that's accelerating as fast as ours, nobody has the answer. And so that then means we have to ask better questions about the future. But the problem is, you know when kids are the most curious, when they ask the most questions? It's when they're 4 years old. But then as soon as they get into our schools, they become less and less curious, which is doing them a great disservice, because we need to tap into that curiosity and that creativity, because that's what's going to keep them flexible and adaptable in this ever-changing, accelerating world.
Teaching the kids how to learn is an old phrase. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Absolutely. But what this then means, I would argue, is that teachers and professors are going to have to unlearn what it is they think their job is. In many cases, they think it is imparting knowledge to younger people. And that's not to say there isn't still a certain role for that, but I would say they need to change their skill set to say, how do we help kids ask better questions? How do we keep them curious, creative? How do we get them more comfortable with playing around with different ideas, disparate ideas from different academic disciplines, to see how they might come together and lead to some new insights?
And from what you're seeing, are the schools, are the universities making that change, or do they have a long ways to go?
No, they're not. They have a long way to go. Here's another quote that I think will, it certainly got my attention, and it should get your listeners' attention. 65% of all kindergartners today are going to be working in jobs and industries that don't even exist by the time they graduate from high school. Now, what that means is it's very easy to see which jobs might go away. Retail clerks, truck drivers, AI is going to put some banking and doctoring and lawyer jobs out. It's far more difficult to imagine those jobs that don't yet exist. But just because we can't imagine what those jobs might be doesn't mean that someone else won't imagine. And so this is where it gets back to creativity and curiosity and the power of questions. From my perspective as a futurist, there's going to be no shortage of problems in the world. And as long as there are problems, there are going to be opportunities. And we need to figure out how to address affordable housing, how to address climate change, how to address and create ever more sustainable energy sources. How do we lower the cost of education, particularly higher education? I mean, I'm here on the campus of Marquette University. I don't know what the tuition is, but I know it's a private university and it's not cheap. It's simply not sustainable. And it's incumbent upon the Marquette universities of the world to change and leverage these new technologies to deliver better, more effective education at a lower price.
And the same could go for public universities as well.
Oh, yes. And it has to, because it's not just going to be the healthcare and the manufacturing and the trucking industry that are going to be disrupted. Higher education has the potential of being absolutely disrupted. In 10 years' time, the possibility that only half of the colleges and universities that currently exist will still be in existence in 10 years' time, from my perspective as a futurist, it is well within the realm of possibility.
That's pretty bold.
It is, but think about this. 10 years ago, I don't think anybody was thinking that the business model of strangers giving strangers rides was going to disrupt the taxi industry, and yet it has. And today, Uber and Lyft, market cap of $100 billion, which makes them more valuable than Ford, General Motors, and Fiat Chrysler combined. You can't tell me that there might not be some entrepreneur out there who says, I have a better way to deliver what higher education is currently delivering at a fraction of the cost. I might not be able to do it, but that's not to say someone in this world of 7.5 billion people might not come up with a better way to educate people.
And the education issue is important as you're preparing people for the workforce, because the workforce is changing as well. Is that right? Or the workplaces?
Yes. These industries, they feel the effect of all of the advances in artificial intelligence, the Internet of Things, the transition from 4 to 5G, and they recognize they need a different type of worker, a worker who is more flexible, who's more adaptable, who's better at solving problems, who is constantly curious, who's really taken this idea of lifelong learning, not just to be a cliche, but to be the life skill that's going to keep them relevant in the future, that they're going to have to constantly learn. And so going back to higher education, I think one of the things they have to unlearn is the idea that education is this four-year term, that you can then somehow imbue people with everything that they need to know, and for the next 40, 50 years of their career, they're going to be able to adjust. In tomorrow's world of change, we all have to become lifelong learners. And I think that represents a huge opportunity for universities to start reaching out to people in their late 20s, early 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, even later in life.
The bottom line matters for the workers too, if they're looking down the road of retirement someday or buying a house or at least a nice apartment. This matters for real life.
Absolutely. If anyone thinks that they can have essentially a middle-class lifestyle without lifelong learning, they're simply deluding themselves. Every industry is going to be affected by change, and we all need to embrace lifelong learning.
So you've looked at and written about trends transforming tomorrow. Are these education ones key, and what else is on the horizon?
What else is on the horizon? Well, I think, let me just tell you why I'm personally optimistic about the future. Let me just paint a scenario. In the future, I think many people will have cheap, clean, abundant, affordable, renewable energy. I think that healthcare might be a fraction of the cost of what it is today. Higher education costs are going to go down. Housing might become more affordable, and transportation costs are going to go down. You might think that I'm a wild-eyed optimist, but let me just walk you through those. Transportation costs, at least if you live in the city, Uber and Lyft and advances in autonomous vehicles, more and more people are going to be able to survive without ever owning a car. So they won't have to spend $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 on a new or used car. They won't have to pay for parking. They won't have to pay for insurance. So suddenly they have more money available in which to put a down deposit on a house. Advances in 3D manufacturing are getting really good. There are already some companies who are 3D printing houses at a fraction of the cost. So affordable housing might come down. The medical advances in the very near future, we should be able to prevent disease from ever occurring in the first place. That diagnostic technology is getting so good. So instead of waiting until you get sick and then providing you treatment, let's just prevent it from ever happening in the first place. And that potentially has the opportunity to save trillions of dollars in healthcare costs. And then the advances in renewable energy, solar, battery power technology might allow you to disconnect from your local utility company. So clean energy, preventative healthcare, lower cost, food, housing, transportation, that's a pretty good future.
But the climate is changing, global warming. Is that a dark cloud, and no pun intended?
It's a really dark cloud. Climate change is real. And I always tell people, the industry that's going to settle this is the insurance industry. Why? Because they look at science and they look at data. And the insurance industry, some companies have now stopped insuring the coal industry because they understand it's a future liability. They're going to stop insuring properties along the Florida coastline. Why? Because science and data tells them that's a bad deal, and we're not going to do it. So from my perspective, this isn't a political issue. This is a science issue, and the science is overwhelmingly real. But I will say the advances in renewable energy are real, and I think the days, coal are certainly numbered. Natural gas, I think, is even going to be numbered, that as we have continued advances in battery technology, renewable energy is going to get really good and really affordable. So I'm optimistic on that front.
What about chronic problems, street violence, gun violence, poverty? Are those going to stay with us, or does the future hold promise on those?
Really good question. As a futurist, the most difficult thing for anyone to predict is how humans are going to react to all of this. And so, unfortunately, one way to understand what's going to survive in the future is to look back and see what has survived for thousands of years. And unfortunately, poverty and homelessness and war have existed. But It's hard for most people to understand, but this is a factual statement. Today is the best time to ever have been alive in human history. The idea that you might die from poverty, from war, from famine, has never been lower. Now, that is not to say that those things don't still exist, but the odds and the numbers have been getting down. And so while I don't think we can eliminate any of those issues, I think the possibility that poverty and war and gun violence may decrease in the future is a possibility.
Talk about one or two things that could change history in a big way. I mean, very significantly in Wisconsin, the opioid crisis is being blamed for helping lower life expectancy. So what about things like opioid deaths, other things that could creep in or barge in and affect what you're saying?
One of the biggest things that could curtail the future is a massive cyber security hack or attack on a power plant, on a chemical plant, on our satellites in the sky. If our global communication system went down, or if the utility grid were hacked for a considerable amount of time, that could change a lot of things. That a lot of the technologies I talk about do have positive implications, but in a world of more powerful computers, billions and then trillions of sensors, they can be hacked. And so we have to be aware of these what are called black swan events. Highly unlikely events, but if they do happen, they are game changers. And let me just tell you one other that is very real, a solar storm. Most people don't worry about solar weather, but a solar storm could fry every satellite in the sky, which would throw the world into global chaos. Is that likely to happen? No, it's not likely to happen, but if it does, everything changes.
So you're a former state official in Minnesota with long-range planning. When you talk to officials now, do you tell them, have a backup plan?
Oh, absolutely. And I always think that human anatomy is a wonderful analogy. I mean, if an economist was developing the human body, they would say, oh, two lungs, that's inefficient. You can just get by with one. And we can survive with one, but Mother Nature has built in sort of this beautiful redundant system that in the event that we do puncture our lung, we at least can survive long enough to potentially repair the other one. And I think as we think about the future, we're going to have to get used to this idea of how do we build in some strategic inefficiency into our system? How do we have redundant systems? Yes, it's going to cost a little more, and the economists aren't going to be happy, and the shareholders might gripe, but they're going to be very, very thankful if there is one of those rare events that we have these backup systems. And so that is a message that I deliver to political officials, but they're always watching the bottom line, and they're really just looking out 2 or 4 years. They're not thinking long-term, unfortunately, and we need more long-term thinkers in public office and in the citizenry. And maybe that's a wonderful way to end. If anything, what our educational system and the higher ed institutions should be doing is educating children today to understand they're stewards not just of themselves and maybe their kids or grandkids, but 5, 7, 14 generations out.
Jack Ulrich is a Minnesota-based writer, lecturer, and consultant. He spoke with WUWM's innovation reporter Chuck Wormbach while he was in town to speak at Marquette University. We will take one last break and then take a trip to Madison to speak with the oldest and the youngest members of the state legislature. Lake Effect returns with those conversations in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us. If you want to confer with Wisconsin Democratic State Senator Fred Risser of Madison, check the stairs. In over 60 years serving in the Capitol, the 92-year-old has never once taken the elevator. But that's not all that's unique about the senator. Risser is one of the oldest legislators and the longest-serving state legislator in the country. At the other end of the age spectrum is Democratic Representative Kalen Haywood of Milwaukee. He was elected when he was 19. He's now 20. He's one of the youngest state legislators in the country. WUWM's Mayan Silver met them both at the state capitol to learn more about each of them, and they both explain how they got into politics, starting with 20-year-old Haywood.
It's a long time ago, you know, way back in the day. So what happened was when I was 13, I went to go to Mary Elementary School and middle school, and yeah, that's it. So I used to walk to the Boys and Girls Club every day after school, and there was this brochure at the Boys and Girls Club for the Milwaukee Youth Council. I looked at it, it was like the most dope thing ever, so I wanted to apply. But I was like 12 at the time, so I couldn't. When I was 13, I volunteered on State Representative David Bowen's campaign for state. It was his first campaign for state. He was county supervisor. So being involved in that, being involved in nonprofits like Urban Underground, getting politically involved with what was going on, issues around the city, politics, voting, all that. And then coupling that with Alderman Cox, I went to a garden one day and she told me that the youth council seat, I'm old enough now, so I got a youth council, but the seat I had was filled when I was a freshman. So she's like, the seat's opening up, you should apply again. So, of course, I did. I got into the youth council coupled with Urban Underground, coupled with internships at the state with David Bowen, internships at the city with Alderman Cox. And that, I think those being combined really got me to where I am today. I think I would not be here today without internships, the work at Urban Underground, and then the youth council.
And how did you get into politics?
Well, I guess I was sort of born into it. As I say, I'm the fourth generation to represent the area. And when I knew from the day I was born that I was going to get into politics. As a young boy, I used to hand out literature for my dad. He was district attorney when I was a young child, and then he was in the legislature. So my dad had been in politics during my entire life, and I had a lot of respect for him. And I knew that someday I would get into politics. As I say, the fourth generation to represent this area and the fourth political party to represent the area.
Can you point out that photos in the corner over there?
Oh, I have pictures of my generations up there. I'm the only Democrat that represent the area. My dad was in the state Senate, same name, for 12 years as a progressive. My grandfather, my mother's father, served in the state assembly as the Follett Republican. He was the author, by the way, of the Civil Service Act in Wisconsin. And my great-grandfather, who lost an arm in the Civil War, came back and served both in the Senate and the Assembly, and at one time was elected as a Unionist. So this area has been represented by Unionists, by Republicans, by Progressives, by Democrats, in my sense. And they all had the same general outlook. Education was top. Purpose and balancing the budget was good. So the budget and education was one of the reasons the government was formed, you might say. It's very important. And then, of course, you have other issues too. You have transportation, and more recently, environmental concerns have developed. Now, when I started out, the environment was not a very big issue, but it's a much bigger issue now because there's more people and there's more awareness of what's happened. And conditions do change. The government has expanded it. When I started out, the entire state government was in the state capitol. All the bureaucracy was in the state capitol. Now we have over 20 office buildings spread around the state and many others leased by the state. The state has much more action in various fields than they had initially. It's interesting to see the evolution, and I'm happy that I've had the opportunity to roll with the waves.
So Senator Risser is not only the longest running state legislature, he's also the only World War II veteran.
Yes.
So he's been in for a long time. What do you feel like the biggest asset that you bring to the legislature now that you've been serving for so long?
I've got an asset that no one else has. I've got 60 years of experience. No one's got that yet.
And how does that change your perspective on what's been happening?
Well, I think you have a little different perspective knowing that history repeats itself. And a lot of things that are going on now that people think are new are not new. They're really old, only in a different way.
And can you give some specifics?
Well, right now we're talking about how the legislature is very partisan. and how one party is controlling things. But I go back 6 years, and actually the Republicans were more controlled back then than they are now. Back when I first was elected, the Republicans had all the state offices and had both houses of the legislature by almost two-thirds margin. So the time of partisanship now was experienced back in my beginnings. And I can tell you that it was pretty bad back then. And I remember the days when Joe McCarthy was the scare person. He was calling people communists, and people were scared out of their wits. Now we have other problems. History repeats itself.
Have there been periods of time that you've served that it hasn't been so cantankerous?
Well, I think so. I think it depends on the personality and the makeup. But I can tell you that you have periods of times when things are partisan. You have periods of times when they aren't quite so partisan.
So, Representative Haywood, what about your take on it, like with the fresh eyes that you have?
I mean, bipartisanship helps us all. I think that us having this, having the Governor Evers being a Democrat controlling the governor's and executive branch and the Republicans controlling the legislature requires us to actually be work together, compromise on some things, so therefore that we make sure that both sides are all represented, and we represent very different constituents sometimes. So we'll make sure that many people are represented, as well as when you think about the experience Senator Richter has and how he tells you about how it used to be a lot tougher, and they can get through that toughness back then, we could definitely get through this now, so it gives me hope.
Were you surprised at how partisan it was in the legislature? Do you feel like there's a lack of respect sometimes among different parties?
I honestly believe that when it comes to party issues, whether it's healthcare or abortion or things like that, that's where we have the divide. But I have noticed that when it comes to human decency issues like human trafficking or education or public safety, those are things we all agree on. We never disagree about the issues. We do disagree about how we take care of the issues. But I do see that being our middle ground. So there's those things that we're just going to disagree with because we're Democrats and we're Republicans. But the things that literally are going to change lives, that are human, these quality of life issues, for the most part, we always agree with those, and we can work on those.
And do you have tactics in terms of working with opposite parties on those kind of middle ground issues so that you can make some headway on other issues?
Me personally, I don't try to make it a party thing or a party line thing. I try to make it this is what constituents care about, and this is what they need, and therefore we move forward on that. But also I try to be understanding, so I ask my colleagues to invite me out to their districts way up north. I want to see what your residents go through, what you go through, what your good things are, what your bad things are, so I have a different understanding of the state, because the state's very different than my district in Milwaukee. So understanding that and being open-minded and open-eared, and then we're working on, okay, you need this, I need this, how do we get both? So just being open-minded and being willing to talk and negotiate and compromise on things.
What's your take on that, Senator Risser?
Well, you know, I was thinking as you were talking about the partisanship in the legislature, and I can remember back when one party had over two-thirds of the majority. Now, under our rules, you can suspend the rules by two-thirds vote. And I can remember arguing the rules in the assembly, when I was in the assembly, and the answer was, they don't need rules. We have two-thirds of the membership. We just vote for suspension of the rules because we don't need rules. And we had a year when I was in, and two-thirds were the other party, and they had no rules. They didn't need rules because they had two-thirds majority, and they used their majority to do anything they want. Times do change.
Do you think the attitude, though, is different now in terms of how charged things are with the internet, with social media, with, you know, everyone having an opinion all the time?
Well, there's no question that the public is more involved now than it was. We have many more contacts with the public, more media contacts, more contacts with email. We never had email. We never had computers. We never had iPhones. And we never had rooms at the time. When I started out, we had no legislative rooms. The legislature only met for 6 months. They took over the chambers for 6 months, and then when they left, the chambers were occupied by the bureaucracy that used the chambers for living quarters and activities. So I would say that things have changed, but just by on scale. The same idea that the majority controls things is there. And whether the majority is one party or the other, they still take over and control things, and it's up to the public to decide which party they want to run the legislature.
And Representative Haywood, in dealing with the public, I mean, you are very young. How does that color, like, how you're dealing with people in the legislature and dealing with your constituents?
I think my age brings this new perspective, this new era of things. I think we are definitely at a different age in politics right now with social media and with the media and with things in general, with different perspectives. Young people are actually becoming way more engaged. I've seen since I ran for office in one, and people from all over the country have reached out to me saying they want to run or they're interested in it, or even just political advice, like what's going on in politics. So young people are getting engaged. But I think that me being young, me being a long 2 decades old, has allowed me to bring these new things. And even when I try to, bills I'm working on or ideas I have or ways of reaching out with the district, they're new ways. They're innovative. They're keeping us upbeat. So I think there's definitely a change in politics coming, and we as state Democrats in Wisconsin have to, well, state legislators in Wisconsin in general, have to kind of get accustomed to that. So I think that me being here allows me to be a convoy, and I'm bridging the gap between some of my elders and the young people to figure out how we can work together on these issues.
And what are some of those ways?
It seems simple, but when I ran for office, things like me using T-shirts. I know in Milwaukee, we hadn't seen T-shirts play a big role in any local or state elections, but now, literally almost everyone has T-shirts for their office or their campaign. So I think little things like that, and people catch on to it, they get involved, everybody wants a shirt, everyone wants to be involved in that process. So I think just ideas like that, I think one idea I've had is creating the app for the phone, for the state. Young people don't want to go on the internet and type in the Wisconsin State Legislature and go to that URL and dig to the website. They want things that are more hands-on and more easier access to things. I think we can do things like the state app and get them engaged and get them involved. We now have more involved residents, which makes us get better in policy. I think that's super important. So engaging that population is going to increase our the quality of our policy. So I think that's what I brought to the table. And just, you know, it's important that young people are represented and have a voice, because the laws we pass today are going to affect us for the next 6 to 7 decades. Like this, like I start telling people all the time, like, what I do now may seem boring, but we're making politics cool again, apparently.
And what are some of the issues that are important for you?
For me, I'm big on breaking the cycle of poverty. My district in Milwaukee is probably, in my opinion, the most diverse in Wisconsin. I have this thriving downtown with this new Fires Reform and all these other businesses. I also have 50206, which is nationally known for one of the worst places to raise a black child. With incarceration rates, homelessness, unemployment, underemployment, poverty. So figuring out ways to break the cycle of poverty through education, economic development, and public safety are key. Those are important to me, but also ensuring that when the young people that come after me, I knew me running at 18, I announced in 18, won at 19. I knew that me running at 18 would be a difficult task, but I feel it was a much needed task, because now young people are getting engaged. They feel they can run. I think that's important to us as the legislature. We have a diverse set of legislators in the state capitol, because it brings different perspectives. So I think even like as far as interns in the offices, it's important to have diverse interns in your office, because they bring new perspectives. So I think diversity is key.
Well, some 20-year-olds or 19-year-olds are sitting around, you know, playing Pokemon or I don't know, the different things just on Snapchat all day. How did you get this fire in you that you want to solve these and tackle these gigantic problems?
For me personally, I think that life's like a puzzle. We have this picture of how we want our state to be, our country, our cities, our homes, our families. And I think that we need every single body to fix this puzzle. If you ever use the puzzle, if you lose a piece, the puzzle's pretty much done for. So I tell people that, I'm 20, I'm in office, I'm doing legislation. There's some 20-year-olds who are at home right now playing Xbox. But I think that that role they're playing is just as important as mine. I think that people are a lot of the time defining what they want to do, what role they want to play. I tell students all the time, some people are going to be engineers and janitors at schools, but be the best janitor you can be. If you want to be a politician, be the best politician you can be. But whatever your role is in life, be the best part. And one of my mentors, who's Representative Jason Fields, told me that either you're at the table or you're being served on the table. And I don't want to be served on the table, I want to be at the table.
Senator Risser, do you see a little bit of yourself in Representative Haywood from when you were younger, potentially?
Well, you know, I think it's wonderful that we have people like Kalen representing areas in this state. The state needs diverse representation. They need young people. They need older people. They need males. They need females. They need whites. They need blacks. They need all. And I think Kalen represents an area that's entirely different than my area. Actually, the area I represent probably has the lowest unemployment in the state, while the area he represents probably has the highest unemployment in the state. And so we represent different areas. And I'm pleased that the area he represents sends a person like Kalen to the legislature to represent them. And he's very articulate, and he's done a great job, and I'm happy to see people like that.
How do you both could see the political process or the legislature improve?
I think that we have a representative form of government, and we have the best legislature that the citizens of this state have elected. If you want to change the legislature, you got to change the representation. I think some of the representatives in the legislature are not the best for their constituency. They're representing maybe special interests. And it's up to the constituents, the voters of this state, to select representatives, we're just representing them, that best take care of them. And I think the voters of the 16th District in Milwaukee have selected a fine man, Kalen, to represent them. I think that my constituents have been fairly satisfied with me to date since they've reelected me. And it's the bottom line is constituent activity, being participant, having the people vote and select their representatives, people who will represent them and represent them well in the legislature. Legislature is no better than the people that are there.
I wish we would talk to each other more and be open-minded. I think that's super important for us to do and put people before politics. That's the end of it. Put people before politics and just talk and figure out how we can get work done instead of how we can make the best headline.
And take the stairs.
And take the stairs. It gets you 60 years.
Thank you, Representative Haywood. Thank you, Senator Risser, for speaking to me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke with 92-year-old Democratic State Senator Fred Risser of Madison and 20-year-old Democratic Representative Kalen Haywood of Milwaukee. They are Wisconsin's oldest and youngest legislators. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect every week with help from Trapper Shep. We also get support from the WUWM news team, including Mayon Silver and Chuck Kornbach this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. And Michelle Matternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.